Benjamin Franklin famously said that nothing in life is certain except death and taxes. However, he forgot to mention human conflict. Throughout our history as a species, we have developed ever more ingenious ways to wage war, either for land, power, or prestige. Yet with constant war comes the perennial challenge of how to make peace. Entire libraries worth of books have been written on the art of diplomacy, and scholars and governments frequently consider how peace can be negotiated and preserved. Indeed, war and peace in the modern world is often understood through the great treaties and summits of the past that somehow managed to limit conflict. From the Congress of Vienna, which brought the decades-long French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars to a close, to the profound legacies of the post-war treaties and conferences that followed the end of the Second World War. But how do wars transform human societies, and what is required to bring them to an end? With me to discuss this vexed question is the distinguished historian Margaret Macmillan, Emeritus Professor of History at both the Universities of Toronto and Oxford. This is Jack Dickens, Literary Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. Margaret, a warm welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'll start off with a very broad question, and that is, how has war shaped human history?
It's helped the rise of empires. It's brought about the destruction of empires. It has moved people around the face of the globe. It's caused great destruction. But in a strange way, it's also caused considerable progress. We probably wouldn't have modern states with their centralized government, with the services they provide to their citizens without wars. We might not have had some of the technological advances we've had, the scientific advances, the medical advances, for example, without wars. Wars make possible the pouring of resources into certain things. And so out of the First World War, we got advances in medical care for people who'd been badly wounded. Out of the Second World War, we got penicillin. We also got nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And so wars have a very mixed legacy for human beings. But as you say, they're deeply woven into our history.
There's been much discussion lately about how the West, and particularly Western Europe, have become complacent about conflict during the so-called period of the post-Cold War peace dividend. Do you think that Western societies have become complacent and need to fundamentally change how they think about war?
Yes, I do think they've become complacent, and I think it's understandable, because if you live in one of the very fortunate parts of the world, and if you've lived in those parts since 1945, as I have, you have not experienced war directly. Wars have happened elsewhere. If you live in Canada, most of the Americas indeed, if you live in Western Europe, if you live in large parts of Asia, if you live in Australia, wars will be something that happened very far away. Your own people may be involved in it, but very few of us know people who fought in wars. With the exception of the Americans in Vietnam, we haven't really had conscription in most developed countries. And so I think a lot of us have got used to the idea that peace is the normal state of affairs, that war is something that isn't going to happen to us, or if it happens, will happen to someone else. But if you look at what's happened since 1945, there's been a major war or a civil war somewhere in the world every year since 1945. And a great many people have died in those wars, whether it's the Great Lakes Wars in Africa, wars in the Middle East, wars in Asia. A great many people have been displaced because of those wars. Their lives have been changed because of those wars. And so I think we've too easily assumed that war is not something that will affect us. And I think what we're beginning to realize today is that even far-off wars can affect us. The conflict now going on in the Middle East, for example, will affect prices, apart from anything else, in the West, may affect us in other ways. And what has also happened is the weapons have become a lot more deadly and a lot more far-reaching, even than they were at the end of the Second World War. So we are no longer as safe from war as we once thought we were.
Last week, a committee of the U.S. Senate formally approved President Donald Trump's decision to rename the U.S. Department of Defense as the Department of War. Is this an important sign of the times? Do you think we're living through a sort of epochal shift away from a period of peace and towards a world where wars will occur far more frequently?
I think the renaming of the Department of Defense is more a gesture towards right-wing politics, the right-wing politics of the United States, and the stress on hyper-masculinity. I mean, look at the cage fighting, which has been taking place on the lawn at the White House. And so I think the idea that war is something manly and vigorous and something you want to do is part and parcel of the thinking of the people who support President, or many of the people who support President Trump. And so I think it's more a gesture in the direction of domestic voters and reflects a sort of mindset of people like the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and the President himself, that war is something that men do. You notice that a lot of the top women in the U.S. military have been eased out, are not being promoted, are being forced to retire early. And there's a lot of talk about how they want warriors, meaning male warriors. So I don't think it means much more than window dressing or sort of gesture in favor of what they believe.
Is there a way for a society to prepare for conflict and to be quite adroit about how it approaches the unstable geopolitics of the present moment without adopting this kind of perhaps overly masculine martial culture and allowing that to take over the institutions of the state?
I think there is, especially when you think of what war is like today. I mean, if you look at who's done the bulk of the fighting and the planning in Ukraine, for example, yes, it certainly has been men fighting, but it's been women fighting too on the battlefields. But the sort of people you need in modern war are also what we might have in the past called the technical nerds, the people who know mathematics, the people who can make drones, the people who can respond very quickly to the changes that the enemy are making in the way they fight wars and in the technology the enemy are using. I mean, one of the great successes of Ukraine and why it's become such a formidable military power is it has become enormously quick at responding to new Russian tactics, new Russian ways of fighting, new Russian technologies, and countering them. And so I think that is going to be the future of a lot of war. You're going to need the scientists. You're going to need the people in the labs. You're going to need the people who don't necessarily bulge with muscles and have, you know, tattoos all over them. You're going to need more and more the people who are in the labs, in the workshops, in the factories, making things. You need thinking about them.
So the modern technology or modern technological innovations can fundamentally change the way in which civil and military relations are structured. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I mean, the technology that is available is always enormously important in the making of war. And technology, as we know, or the introduction of new things like the horse, can make a huge difference the ways in which wars are fought. And those groups of people, whether they're nations or earlier types of groupings, clans, for example, those that can adapt are probably going to do better. I mean, those that adapted first to using the horse and developing a very mobile type of warfare were able to conquer vast swaths of land and take a great many people under their rule. Or the Romans, who were able to use the improved metals in their swords and shields, were able to become a formidable military power. So I think technology has always played a part. And the willingness of society to support the war effort, the ways in which technology can be used. I mean, often technology is something that is developed often first for civilian use, I mean, and then is adapted to war. And one of the reasons that the European powers began to develop such powerful cannon is because they had a whole history of making church bells. They had the metallurgy to make metal that didn't disintegrate as soon as it was banged or an explosion took place. And so often things that are developed for one purpose will be adapted to another. And it's the nations or groups of people who are adaptable, I think, who often do best in war.
In your acclaimed book, The War That Ended Peace, you look at the long peace dividend or the long period of relative peace that preceded the First World War. And you make the point that while we know what happened subsequently, we know that the First World War broke out and it was a disaster for Europe and the world. We need to keep in mind the forces that are pulling towards peace in that period, as well as those which are driving nations towards war. When you look at the current geopolitical environment today, do you see forces pulling towards peace as well as those moving towards conflict?
I think I do. I mean, historical comparisons are never very neat. And the world of before the First World War is different from the world of today. But there are interesting parallels. And I think there's always a danger when a conflict breaks out that you look back and think, well, it was bound to break out. Somehow, curiously enough, the bigger the conflict, the more we think, well, it was just a powder keg. It was often an image used of Europe in 1914, a powder keg waiting for someone to set the first spark to bring about a big explosion. But I think we need to look also at all the reasons why people didn't want to go to war and the institutions that were being developed and the prohibitions on war. I mean, the period before the First World War was a period of enormous development, very rapid development in things like international law and international institutions and international agreements. And you got non-governmental organizations, for example, like the International Committee of the Red Cross, which was established in Geneva and became something that tried to deal with some of the worst consequences of war for civilians and for those who were fighting. And you had the nations of the world, or many of them, meeting at The Hague before the First World War and trying to develop conventions about what sorts of weapons could be used and what sorts couldn't. So I think there was a strong series of motives. There was considerable public support, growth of institutions before the First World War, and again after the First World War, against war. And I think often wars come about either because somebody wants it. I mean, Hitler wanted war. He was prepared to fight. In fact, he was disappointed when he got half of Czechoslovakia in 1938 without having to go to war for it. He felt it was bad for the German people, that they needed the stimulus of a war to bring out their true nature. So you will get those who want war, who bring about war, but you also get leaders who stumble into it by mistake. They don't think it's going to happen. They think they can threaten the other side, the potential enemy, and there'll be a bit of a discussion, and then someone will back down. And sometimes they find themselves in positions where they can't back down, or they have started something and they notice that the other side is beginning to respond, and so the things tip over often into war quite quickly. And so I don't think war is something that's inevitable, but it often comes about because either people want it or because there is some sort of accident. And that fear, that is something I worry about, because before the First World War, the assumptions being made increasingly were that there would be a war. And the military plans by 1914 were all offensive. All the big powers had offensive military plans, which meant they were going to attack. And if you plan to attack, you probably want to do it first. And so the pressure in any crisis was to start mobilizing, be ready for war, and don't worry about what the other side is going to do, or try and do it before the other side begins to mobilize itself. And that, I think, is very dangerous. I think you begin, and people did begin to think in scenarios, they are going to fight us. If you're Germany, you think that Russia is getting much too strong and it'll take on Germany one day. And this was a real fear. And Germany and Russia, before 1914, had a common border. And so this was a very present fear. And I think I see something of the same happening today. I was very struck once talking to someone in the American military who said to me, when we fight China, he didn't say if. And I thought that was really significant. I said, you're assuming it's going to happen. He said, yes, I guess I am. And I think people in Beijing may be assuming the same. And that makes war, I think, more likely.
And what role does prestige play in driving competition and conflicts between great powers, whether it's China and the US today, or Germany, France, Russia, Great Britain, before the First World War?
I think it does. It's the prestige of the nation. We can't afford to be seen to be backing down. I mean, in a way, it's the same sort of stress on having warrior values that we see perhaps in certain circles today. The stress was there before the First World War, and there's a complaint that, you know, the younger generation weren't ready to sacrifice. Young men were not really prepared to fight. What was wrong with them? And young women weren't prepared to give birth to soldiers and send their men off to war. And I think we're getting the same sort of thing today. And also among leaders, you get notions of prestige. The leaders of Austria-Hungary, who stumbled into the First World War, I think they were completely unready to go to war, as the behavior and the reactions of their military showed. But they felt they couldn't back down. One of the senior ministers said, as Austria-Hungary entered the war on the side of Germany, he said, it may be the end of the empire, but a great power cannot go down ingloriously. And there was that attitude. And Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, when he went to the House of Commons to get a vote for Britain to enter the war on the side of France and Russia and also on the side of Belgium, which was being invaded, Sir Edward Grey said, we have obligations of honor. And so I think questions of prestige, questions of honor, often affect those making decisions. And I think we see it in the language today. You see it in the language of President Putin, who talks about the glories of Russian history and the form of the great power of Russia. And I think we see it in it's often the words of Xi Jinping. He talks about the great Chinese past, how he wants to restore China as a great power. And you see it in often the words of President Trump and his supporters, that the United States is the world's superpower. And that carries certain obligations in a curious way, that you have to show your power.
The great powers before the First World War were driven by this prestige and this desire to see themselves triumph over their geopolitical adversaries. But they also believed that they could manage conflict, that they could keep it within bounds, they could stop a catastrophic war from breaking out. Is there any sense today that we can manage this competition over prestige and resources? Is there a hopeful message to be taken from the past that suggests that actually nations can cohabit even if they are competing with one another.
Oh yes, I mean, it's happened for a lot of the past, and I think we need to remember that there have been long periods of peace in the past. I mean, Europe enjoyed, given its bloody history, Europe enjoyed really quite a peaceful century in the 19th century. It didn't mean there weren't wars, but they tended to be short, and they tended to be only between two powers, or at most three or four. It didn't become a general war. So no, I think there is a possibility of avoiding conflict, and the danger can be that you begin to think you can always avoid it. I mean, before the First World War, if I'm sorry I go on about the First World War, but it's a very important example, I think. Before the First World War, there were a series of crises in the Balkans from 1908 onwards, when there was talk of war, and there was, as people said, saber rattling. There was the threat of war. And then there'd be a conference of ambassadors, there'd be meetings, there'd be letters exchanged, and Europe pulled back from war. The danger in that, in retrospect, was when they reached the summer of 1914, and there was another crisis in the Balkans, too many leaders and too many parts of the public thought, well, this is just another in that series of crises. There'll be a lot of talk, there'll be bluster, there'll be, you know, perhaps they'll mobilize, the different sides will mobilize some troops, they'll talk about getting ready for war. They don't mean it. There'll be another conference of ambassadors, there'll be another settlement like there was. And they tipped over the edge, I think, almost without realizing it. They got to the point where they couldn't pull back. And it was, I think, a dangerous thing. And I think, you know, we need to be careful what we say. I mean, it's a bit, not entirely unlike a fight in a bar. People will shout at each other. You know, they've had too much to drink. They start shouting at each other. They disagree about a sporting match. You know, the World Cup, I'm sure, is going to produce such incidents. And they reach a point where they find it difficult to back down because their pride is at stake. And I think that's the problem.
Will there be a way for President Trump or for one of his successors to perhaps moderate the tone of the United States? Is it a moderation of tone that would diffuse international tensions, or do we need something that's perhaps more systematic? Do we need the United States to once more act as a superpower that's trying to preside over an order, over a sense of a Pax Americana? What would the solution be to the current tensions that exist in the world today?
I think a combination, perhaps, of both. I mean, I think words matter. And I have really have come to dislike the idea that public policy can be made by posts, by Substack posts, by Twitter, or X as it's now called. You know, this is not the way to make policy, and this is not the way to have serious reflection. And the danger is that it's sort of a sensation, and then everyone forgets about it, or it isn't forgotten about, and it is taken perhaps too seriously. And so I worry about that. You know, leaders seem to be under real pressure to make policy on the fly, not to sit around and talk to their advisors, and not to listen, and not to decide things more slowly. And I think that can be dangerous. I think there is a sense that I speak as a Canadian, but I've talked to others in different countries. There is a sense that if a different administration comes in the United States with a different sort of rhetoric, things may change. But the United States, I think, has damaged its relations under this administration. It's damaged its relations with other countries. And in my view, needlessly alienated countries like Canada and Denmark, for example, which have been very loyal allies. I mean, we haven't caused them much trouble. They can certainly complain about us, and there's lots to complain about. But I think we have been good allies. And you can't suddenly turn around and say, well, sorry about the last few years, things were a bit difficult, but let's be friends again. We know in human relations that renewing friendships can be more complicated than that, particularly if the memories are bad, and particularly if there have been things that have happened that are rather difficult to forget. So I think there is that. I think the question is also whether the American public, who are in the end, of course, going to have to pay for and have paid for the costs of being a superpower. I mean, the British found this in their time, that being a superpower is all very well, but it costs a lot. And your publics get tired of it. And they begin to ask, why are we paying taxes to maintain outposts on the other side of the world? What good is it doing for us? And so I think whether the United States will want to go back to being a superpower much engaged in the world, whether the rest of the world will welcome that or not, are questions that are very much open. I mean, I think what I hope we're seeing is a recognition among big powers, and I think the Chinese are very much aware of this. And the Chinese, on the whole, like rules. They like predictability. They like trade to go on. They don't like the threat of conflict disrupting trade, disrupting their oil supplies, for example. we have to hope that those countries and smaller powers recognize that they all have an obligation to try and work together. And whether that will be through the United Nations is another question. But I think there are enough people in the world, let's hope, and I do hope, and I do think there are enough people in the world who do understand the dreadful consequences if a major war was to break out. I mean, the weapons we have, the increased piling of nuclear stockpiles, the nations who have nuclear weapons have now is so much greater than the two bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, the capacity to really destroy life on the planet is there. And I think there is a real realization among leaders, both in democratic countries, but also countries that are more authoritarian, that we really are playing with fire here. There's a really dreadful gamble that we will all suffer if a war breaks out.
I'd like to pick up on what you said there about diplomacy by social media, which obviously Donald Trump is very active in pursuing on Truth Social. It reminds me of something that you mention in your book, The Peacemakers, which looks at the story of the Paris Peace Conference after the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles. And you mentioned that peacemaking took an awful long time back then. President Woodrow Wilson had to cross the Atlantic by boat. They had to sit down for months at a time and hammer out various different peace settlements across Europe and the Middle East. Is part of the problem now that the information economy and the information world that we inhabit, does that make sort of calm, patient peace building much more difficult for statesmen and stateswomen?
I think it probably does. I mean, they're constantly being scrutinized, and voters want results, and voters don't want to pay more taxes. And if there's an expensive foreign war going on somewhere, voter support tends to drop unless there's an existential threat. And I think for the American electorate, the conflict that the United States has become involved in the Middle East is wildly unpopular. The polls seem to show that very few Americans support it. And I think a lot of Americans would say, what are we doing over there? And why are we spending this money? And why are our people in the service dying and being wounded over there? What's it to do with us? And I think that's always going to put pressure on governments. But as we know from history, it's relatively easy to get into a war, but often very difficult to get out. And wars have a habit of running away with those who try and make them. You know, so often we have heard, and it's happened, so often in the past, and it still happens today, we'll have a quick war, we'll have a surgical strike, we'll get it over with, and then we'll sit down and talk about peace. It doesn't happen like that. And when Hitler went to war in the Second World War, Kaiser Wilhelm, the Kaiser who'd been in power, not in power, but in office, who was the ruler of Germany at the time of the First World War, who was in exile in the Netherlands, said famously, "The war will run away with him as it did with me." And I do think for once Wilhelm II was saying something sensible, which was not necessarily his practice. But I do think it's true that wars have a way of running away. And the danger is the longer they go on, the more difficult it is to settle. I mean, think of our own lives. We all know people who've had a very difficult divorce, and it makes it much more difficult for them to agree on anything, even if they finally do get an agreement, or businesses where the partners fall out, and just how expensive that can be and how difficult it can be to settle. And I think we also face a problem today that because of social media, we expect quick results. And negotiating peace, I mean, if you think negotiating a business contract is difficult, you think of how long and how many lawyers it takes to negotiate a merger, say, between two big corporations. Negotiating peace and making sure that the terms are all clear and making sure there aren't loopholes that the other side can go straight through is a really painstaking business. And so when I hear that, everything's been settled in a particular conflict and they're going to shake hands next week, I wonder who's looking after the details, because the details really matter.
And I wonder as well, when you look at how technology has changed the battlefield in Ukraine and also in the Middle East, on the one hand, it's created this hubristic sense that a surgical strike or one massive push can lead to a decisive victory. But on the other, it's led to these conflicts becoming bogged down, with these conflicts running away with the intentions of those who started them. Is it harder now to win a decisive victory in a conflict? And does that make peace building or peacemaking much more difficult as well?
I'm trying to think of the last decisive victory. Well, look, I mean, I think it still can be done. The coalition that went in to liberate Kuwait after Saddam Hussein invaded it at the beginning of the 1990s won a very decisive victory, and they got what they wanted. And I think wisely, in my view, but you could certainly disagree with me, they didn't go into Iraq itself and try and overthrow the regime. But the regime was brought to heel, and Saddam Hussein's regime did not cause trouble to its neighbors ever again. It certainly caused enough misery and dreadful consequences for its own population. But as far as the Middle East was concerned, Iraq had been defanged. And so I think possible victories are still possible. But it's one thing, I think people often get fixated on the victory on the battlefield. There'll be one big push, there'll be one big battle. But if you look at the great battles of history, a lot of them didn't lead to that side that won the victory on the battlefield winning. A lot of militaries still study the Battle of Cannae, where Hannibal defeated the Roman forces. And, it's an extraordinary victory, and it's still studied. But in fact, Carthage lost. Hannibal's country, Carthage, lost that war and was devastated. Rome won, and it was a war of attrition. And I think wars are often won not by the dramatic battlefield adventures, which of course play a part, but they're won often in the long run by attrition. Which side can hold out longer and keep its supplies flowing to the battlefields longer?
And when it finally comes to peacemaking and peace settlements and the diplomacy surrounding it, what are the qualities that statesmen and stateswomen need to successfully end a war?
You need to know who you're dealing with. You need to know what the other side is about. As much as possible, you need to know what they want. If you're going to sit down and face someone across a table, you need to know something about that person, as you do, in fact, in any negotiation. That you need to get some sense of what the other side will accept and won't accept. And so I think diplomacy, which is often, I think, too often written off as, oh, it's just people in smart coats, talking to each other and drinking champagne with each other. That isn't what diplomacy is. It's really hard work. And it's having the experts there who can look at the details. I mean, during the Cold War, when big arms negotiations were negotiated between the United States and the Soviet Union, for example, the SALT I, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty in the 1970s, when those were negotiated, there were teams of people there, and they went over every detail, and they got really involved in things like the thrust power of the rockets. I mean, these things are highly technical, but actually very important. And so the idea you can just sit down, have a handshake, make peace very quickly, that you don't need the diplomats, you don't need the experts, I think is wrong. Because if you're dealing with people who do have those people on their side, they're going to run rings around you.
The experts and the professionals are necessary. They're a fundamental part of building a successful diplomatic settlement. Is there still space for the amateurish brilliance of a kind of a Bismarckian figure, someone who brings an unorthodox approach to diplomacy but ends up coming up with unexpected results?
I think there's always room for someone who is very, very good at negotiating and very good at dealing with other people. I mean, Bismarck always compared himself to someone who played chess, and he knew the chessboard very well. I think those who think that they can just walk into a room and charm people on the other side are dreaming. And President Roosevelt in the Second World War thought he could just meet up with Stalin, that he'd charm him, the Soviet Union, the United States would get on with each other, and they'd become sort of partners in the peace that was to come. And he didn't know enough about Stalin. It was difficult to find out. But the idea you can just suddenly win over the other side by just being really nice and friendly and charming them, I don't think works. I think you need to have someone who is capable of learning about them. And Henry Kissinger, in some ways, was unorthodox. He was a university professor, but he had an absolute talent for diplomacy. And he spent a great deal of time trying to figure out who his opponents were or the people on the other side were and what they wanted and what they were like. So I don't think you can just float into diplomacy and make a success of it. I mean, I once talked to a very distinguished Canadian diplomat who said Henry Kissinger was really unusual in that he came out of the diplomatic world but had such a talent for it. But I think in most cases you need people who've had years of experience and know what they're talking about. You also need the experts. You need people who speak the language of the people you're dealing with. You need the interpreters. You need the people who can tell you something about who they are. Because otherwise, how are you going to make any sort of overtures to them?
And what are the lessons when we look at the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine, but also in the Middle East? Now, there has been a memorandum of understanding that's been somewhat agreed between the United States and Iran in the Middle East, but there's a long way to go before that solidifies into something more permanent. How should the Trump administration, but also European capitals, try to approach these conflicts? How could they bring about peace in these two parts of the world?
Well, they could bring about peace, I suppose, if the main protagonists want peace. And it's not clear to me that Russia, at the moment, wants peace. Putin still seems to think that he can do a final sort of push and that he can force Ukraine to give him what he wants. I think he's in something of a desperate situation because the war, which was meant to be 3 or 4 days, is now 4 years. And I think this is really a problem for him. It's now longer, as people have been pointing out, than Russia fought in the Second World War. But for him to back down will cause him all sorts of problems at home, I think. And so he's caught between a war that he, I think, would probably like to see brought to an end, and his own public, and a Ukraine, of course, which isn't prepared to give him everything he wants. Now, whether outside powers could intervene, and sometimes that has happened, whether the United States, whether Turkey, whether India, whether the European Union, for example, could get together and try and work out some sort of agreement that would suit both sides, is a big question. I mean, at the moment, I think the United States doesn't seem to be interested in bringing the Ukraine war to an end, or they would be prepared to see it brought to an end on Russia's terms simply to end the conflict. But that leaves aside what Ukraine would want to do. And as far as conflict in the Middle East, difficult to know. I mean, I don't know. Things will change so quickly, but at the moment, what has been issued is, as far as I know, a press release. It's not even an official document from either the Iranian or the American governments. And there will be apparently a further period. There'll be some sort of, something will be signed, we don't know what. And then there'll be a further period of 60 days. But 60 days is not very long to deal with all the highly technical issues of the enriched uranium, for example, that Iran has, or the types of missiles it has. I mean, the agreement that President Obama made took, I think, 2 years to negotiate. And it was highly technical, but I think it was negotiated with care because the Americans didn't want to leave any loopholes for the Iranians to continue to develop their nuclear weapons or continue to develop the capacity to carry them. And so I'm worried that there's sort of real pressure to get this settled quickly. And I worry, as I always do, about the lack of knowledge. I mean, I heard the other day that in the British Foreign Office, there is precisely one person who speaks Persian. Now, if that's true, that's not a good sign, because Britain, like other powers in Europe, needs to know something more about Iran and be able to understand and, if necessary, decode the message that the Iranians are sending in their own language.
I'd like to return to the prospect of great power conflicts again, particularly between the United States and China. Are these countries locked into what the Harvard historian Graham Allison has called the Thucydides trap? Do you have a view on that? Is some kind of conflict inevitable? You seem to suggest earlier that certainly the policymakers and military figures in the US are preparing for that eventuality.
I think they are, but I think they're also thinking of alternatives. And I have certain reservations about the Thucydides trap. To begin with, I can never pronounce it properly. But I think it's not a foregone conclusion. It's not predictive. It's an observation, but there have been cases where two great powers have clashed, or it looks like they're going to clash, and they haven't. And I'll give you an example from the 1890s. The British were still very influential in Latin America, even though, of course, they'd lost their foothold in the 13 colonies. They still had Canada, and they still had what was then called British Guiana. And they also had done most of the investing in things like railways, which were key strategic and key economic institutions in Latin America. So the British were highly influential in Latin America, and they had islands in the Caribbean as well. And the Americans were increasingly edgy about this. They saw the British as a threat. There was talk about how the British need to be pushed out of the Caribbean, pushed out of British Guiana. And there was a dispute over the borders between British Guiana and Venezuela. And there was talk both in the United States and Britain about war that we're going to have to fight. It would have been a very one-sided fight, I think, because the British had the Navy and the Americans at that point didn't yet have much of a Navy, although they were building one, they were beginning to build one. And instead of a war happening, I mean, the United States was the rising power under the Thucydides trap. The established power is the one that is there, like Britain was, and the rising power, and they're bound to clash because the rising power won't be kept down by the established power any longer. And this was a perfect example of what could have been that sort of conflict between the United States and Britain, and it didn't happen. wiser heads on both sides said, this is ridiculous. We're fighting over a bit of territory between two countries. We don't need to do this. We don't need to fight. The British were prepared to make concessions to the United States, and the United States were prepared to pull back. And so I don't think it is predictive. I think there are examples of where this didn't happen. I also find the whole notion, I did go back and read Thucydides, and if I had been asked which is the rising power and which is the declining power, I would have had trouble, because Athens was a great sea power and Sparta was a great land power. So which was the more powerful, and what does power mean, actually? So I think we should be careful of how we take this. We should not assume it's predictive. And as I said earlier, I think it's really dangerous when nations begin to think we have no alternative. We're bound to have to fight them.
Might one lesson from the origins of the First World War be that actually it's an unexpected crisis on the peripheries between different powers that leads to an unexpected cascade into war? Is there any way that powers can predict something like, for example, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo? Or are these events just so explosive and unexpected that they lead to this, like I said, cascade into conflict?
That is the danger. I mean, I'm an historian, and so unlike political scientists, I probably don't look for patterns as much as I should. And I don't look for sort of laws that seem to determine things in history. I mean, I think I'm very much aware, as a lot of historians are, of accident and circumstance and coincidence. And I think Austria-Hungary certainly wanted an excuse to try and bring Serbia to heel. They had lost control over it. They regarded it as a poisonous little territory country on their southern border that was tempting the South Slavs, the people very like the Serbs, the Croatians and the Slovenians inside the Austrian Empire, plus Serbs inside the Austrian Empire, to want to leave. And so Serbia was something of a threat to the very existence of Austria-Hungary. And so in the Austro-Hungarian government, there was a lot of talk about we have to finish Serbia off once and for all. We have to make it a sort of vassal state again or whatever. And so the assassination of the heir to the Austrian-Hungarian throne was an absolute godsend in many ways. And the irony was, I mean, he wasn't popular, so people didn't particularly mind that he'd been assassinated. And the irony was that he had been one of the firmest voices against trying to destroy Serbia. And by assassinating him, that voice was gone. And so you had the hawks saying, now's our chance. You know, everyone will be sympathetic. And there was sympathy around Europe for this. There was quite a lot of sympathy. You know, this was an act of terrorism. The Serbian government wasn't directly involved, but it seemed to a lot of people, and I think with reason, that the Serbian government or elements in the Serbian government knew what was going to happen, what was being planned, and had helped to provide the weapons and had helped to smuggle them into Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was part of Austria-Hungary. So yes, I think it was an accident, and there were enough people in Austria-Hungary making decisions who were ready to use it. So I think that is a danger, that something will happen. And I think it also matters, and again, I speak probably more as an historian than a political scientist, it really matters who's in power. You know, who's in the government, who's making the decisions. You know, if you hadn't had certain things in the First World War, if you'd had a czar in Russia who was a bit of a stronger character, who hadn't given way to his generals, Russia might not have gone to war. If you'd had Franz Ferdinand, who was the emperor of Austria-Hungary, he'd been very sick that spring, and he was very old and very much alone. If you'd had someone else who was younger and more vigorous, they might have said to the generals, don't be crazy. Or if you'd had in Germany, a Kaiser who had been prepared to use his authority to stop the general staff from doing what they wanted, it might have been different. We'll never know. But sometimes it really does matter. And I think, again, look at the Second World War. If it hadn't been for Hitler, would we have had another war in Europe? I'm not sure.
Thinking about the present day, do you think that there's a danger, perhaps, that in fixating on Taiwan, for example, as a flashpoint, an area where obviously the relations between China and the United States are actually quite ritualized, there's a kind of fudge that seems to have worked so far, they might miss something that happens, a shock event in a flashpoint that's lesser known, that might lead to this kind of tumble towards war?
What I worry about, I guess two things. I mean, Xi Jinping is getting to an age where, like a lot of people, he thinks about his place in history. And he's always made it clear that he thinks Taiwan should be incorporated into China. And he's not liked the rather ambiguous state that it's in. So there's that, I think. You know, he has acquired more and more power over the years. And it's not clear how much resistance there would be within the government or the military to his order, if he were to give an order to try and incorporate Taiwan forcefully. So there is that. I think. The other thing I worry about is that there might be an incident. I mean, we have in the seas around Taiwan, you have American naval vessels, American submarines, for example, American aircraft carriers. You also have American planes, and you have Chinese ones. And they have come very close to bumping into each other. Now, what if by mistake a Chinese plane shoots down an American plane or vice versa, or one side sinks a ship that belongs to the other side? Would there then be an outcry? Would public opinion begin to get involved? And that's a danger always. I mean, you know, the publics begin to get engaged and governments then get under pressure to do something. And so I worry about an unforeseen incident provoking a wider crisis.
Finally, I just want to ask you about the utility of what's called applied history. And the general idea is obviously that you take what's happened in the past and you try to understand the present through it. And you try to achieve certain desirable outcomes and avoid outcomes that aren't desirable. Do you think, as an historian, there is a danger that we sometimes overestimate the value of history as well as underestimate it? Can we draw parallels that are too restrictive and that actually limit the options that we have available to us?
It's always a danger, I think, that we'll get ourselves into thinking in certain ways and not considering alternatives. You know, the use of analogies, which a number of historians have written about in a very interesting way, can be a trap. If you think that something is just like what had happened in the past, or very like what had happened in the past, you will make decisions based on that to avoid perhaps some of the catastrophes of the past. There's a very interesting book by someone called Yuen Feng Kong about the way in which the Americans use the appeasement analogy, you know, the attempt to appease the dictators before the Second World War so appetites would be satisfied and they wouldn't want to go to war. And the Americans used that analogy with Vietnam. And it became almost a self-fulfilling thing that, you know, we have to do this because otherwise we will get another person like Hitler and someone like Mussolini who will take, you know, create a general war. And George Ball in the State Department, who knew Asia very well, was one of the few people who spoke against this. And he said, we should consider another analogy, not just the appeasement. We should consider what happened to the French in Vietnam. They lost a war in Vietnam because they underestimated the Vietnamese. The war was unpopular at home. And he was dismissed. Those in the State Department and others who were arguing for more involvement in Vietnam, an escalation of American involvement in Vietnam, said that was the French. We will deal with it differently. Well, in fact, what happened to the Americans in Vietnam is very like what happened to the French. And so I think looking at the past can be helpful and give you warnings as long as you don't get trapped in a particular way of interpreting it.
Just on another note, it's interesting as well that the appeasement analogy was the one that Anthony Eden and Guy Mollet used when they were thinking about NASA and the Suez Crisis. So it's interesting how for a certain generation that loomed large in the imagination and, like you said, made them overlook things that perhaps would have been more useful. Anyway, thank you very much for the conversation. I think that's a good note on which to end. Margaret McMillan, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I hope I haven't left you and anyone else very depressed. I think, look, we have to keep hoping, don't we?
Exactly. We need to have reasons for optimism as well. Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.